It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up after White House Dr. Ronnie Jackson took himself out of consideration to run the Department of Veterans Affairs, we'll look at some of the major challenges facing veterans and that agency. First, people in Superior have been ordered to evacuate a part of the area following explosions at an oil refinery. WPR reporter Danielle Kading has been covering the story and joins us now with the latest. Danny, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, talk us through, we've been hearing in the news, talk us through some of the latest going on there. The story has been developing through the afternoon.
Yeah, the latest that we know is that they're taking precautions to evacuate an area that's 10 miles south of the Husky Energy Refinery and 3 miles east and west on either side, and another mile northeast and northwest around that refinery. And they're doing that because there's a tank of product at the oil refinery that if it ruptures, it could create a plume that could be hazardous to people if they were to breathe it in. That's according to Douglas County's Emergency Management Director, Keith Kessler. So they've done some modeling about, the wind and where things are going with that fire right now. And so they're making sure that they're evacuating people from that area just in case that tank were to rupture. And that tank contains hydrofluoric acid. That's hydrofluoric, not hydrochloric. It's a strong inorganic acid. It's used mainly for industrial purposes, and according to the Centers for Disease Control, that acid is fairly weak, but it can cause serious health effects if people are exposed to it. So they're just taking whatever precautions needed to keep people safe, and so people in that area that are affected are being asked to, if they live in the county, go to Four Corners Elementary School. If they live in the city, they can go to the Yellow Jacket Union at UW Superior, or they can, go to friends or family and look for them to put them up in the meantime until they know what's going on with the fire.
And Danny, I've seen pictures in news coverage. Can you set the scene? What does it look like from on the ground in Superior?
Initially it didn't look that bad earlier this morning, and they had said that they had gotten the fire under control. But then later on this afternoon, around somewhere between the noon hour and 1, it started to really plume up. There's a lot of black smoke, and you can see it for miles. So it looks pretty striking anywhere you're at in the city.
One piece of good news, anyway, at least at this point, reports of no fatalities, all workers at the plant apparently accounted for. Is that right?
That's what they're saying so far. There were 5 people that were transported to a Duluth hospital. We actually have a couple of different hospitals here in Duluth Superior. So I think it's a grand total of 6 people that were transported to hospitals to be treated. And another 7 were treated and released at the scene, according to Douglas County's Emergency Management Director. Right now, there's still a lot that's not known. Firefighters are still fighting that blaze, but, it's a really difficult job for them right now.
Right.
So
this
they're trying to do what they can.
This isn't your ordinary fire. It's a fire at an oil refinery with a lot of petroleum products around, and as we heard, hydrofluoric acid, industrial chemicals, things like that. Is this a case where they're going to bring in outside help to deal with this?
Yes, they have put out a mutual aid call to St. Louis County, and St. Louis County is coming in to help them with this, and they've set up an emergency command post here in the city. So they have reached out, but it's important to note that they have trained for this. There was a fire incident team at the refinery. So this is something that they always knew could possibly happen, and they are addressing it in the best way that they know how.
And has there been any talk yet about the possible cause of the initial fire and subsequent explosion?
Yeah, the cause of the initial fire, it looks to appear, according to Superior's fire chief, Steve Panger, resulted from an asphalt leak. They're saying that there was an explosion in a smaller tank that either contained asphalt or crude oil, and that's how the fire started. And people who were nearby at the time and heard the explosion said they heard and felt the explosion, and one eyewitness said that it sounded like a bomb going off.
We'll leave it there for now. Danny, thanks for keeping us up to date.
Yeah, thanks, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR's reporter in Superior. We talked with her about today's explosions at an area oil refinery and evacuations. We'll keep an eye on the story as it develops. President Trump's pick to lead the Department of Veterans Affairs has withdrawn his nomination. Rear Admiral Ronnie Jackson, who currently serves as the White House physician, cited the distraction caused by what he called completely false and fabricated allegations. Those include allegations of drinking on the job, poor management, and overprescribing of medications. The White House said Jackson would remain in his current role, and this morning on Fox News, President Trump was asked whether he's got someone else in mind to run the VA.
I do, actually, but I better not give it. Maybe we'll do it on my next call. I do. I think we're going to have somebody great.
All right.
Somebody that's more, you know, look, the Admiral is not a politician, which is what I liked.
Trump went on to say that the person he has in mind is somebody with political capability. No matter who ends up running the department, they'll face a lot of difficult challenges. Emily Wax Thibodeau is a national reporter covering veterans and the Department of Veterans Affairs for The Washington Post. Emily, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, you wrote about a lot of challenges facing whoever is going to be the next director of the Veterans Affairs Department. I want to look at some of those. One you write about is staffing. I had no idea, actually, Veterans Affairs is short-staffed, you write, at all levels. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Experts that I speak to every day, veterans themselves, say that everywhere from the very top all the way to janitorial staff, are missing. They're looking for especially critical positions in mental health. PTSD sufferers need to see therapists, and so they're having an effort to hire them, but it's difficult. The private sector pays more, and often veterans have very specific needs, having been through combat, that therapists want to make sure they're prepared for and helpful with.
And I saw a number, something like 30,000 positions unstaffed, basically, throughout Veterans Affairs. That's a huge number.
That's right. And every bureaucracy has staffing issues, and there is a lot of turnover, largely because people will come and serve veterans, perhaps need more money for personal reasons, and go to the private sector and make four or five times that amount. Also because they get frustrated. There's therapists who speak about, you know, seeing 14, 15 people a day. It's just an overload of work. So there's a real need to get the hiring system in place. There's also some issues with the human resources department itself, that's also understaffed. So the people to do the hiring need to be hired.
And this isn't a problem, I imagine, that just happened overnight or in the last year. A staffing shortage that substantial must have taken time to develop, right?
I think it's gone back and forth because it's such a large agency and employs, you know, 350, almost half a million, more than half a million people, 100,000 people. It's been an issue for a long time. There was a hiring freeze in the government. It was lifted for veterans for positions such as doctors. However, the people who were hiring the doctors, they were on a hiring freeze. That caused a backlog.
And another problem that's been in the news, and really the problem that made the VA a focus, a lot of national attention, was the wait time for service members, for veterans seeking various kinds of health care. That emerged, what, 4 or 5 years ago, something like that. And I guess that's got to be connected to that shortage in staffing. What do we know about getting veterans speedy care? What's happening these days?
In 2014, the wait times scandal was revealed. Veterans were waiting very long for care, but people in the system, office managers and others, were fudging the data and saying they were getting care more quickly. That led to the resignation of Eric Shinseki, and has sort of been a new era for the VA. The VA was beloved, was seen as a success story. It educated an entire generation of World War II veterans through the GI Bill, bringing them into the middle class. There were still many veterans who praised the VA's groundbreaking work in amputations, in rehab, in spinal reconstruction, yet it's very difficult to get an appointment. That's why at the crux of some of this issue going on today is outsourcing care at taxpayer expense. It doesn't mean privatizing the VA. It means taxpayers will pay for a veteran to go to GW Hospital or your private facility. That's a big controversial plan. A lot of veterans groups want to see the VA emboldened, the VA improve, the VA spend time hiring, and not send people, not line private corporations with money. It's also very expensive. It constantly runs out of money, the CHOICE program, and senators have to raise more funds, find, move money around, and the veteran secretaries are always going back to Congress to ask for more money.
And this is an issue that people have pointed toward in why President Trump's first appointee as director of the VA was fired, because of differing attitudes over that outside the VA CHOICE healthcare, right?
Exactly. Dr. Shulkin didn't want to go as far as some conservative forces within the administration in outsourcing care. He did want a hybrid system where if there's long wait times, you can go outside the VA and be reimbursed at taxpayer expense, but he did not want too much of that because that means resources that should be spent inside the VA, which a lot of veterans view as a special place that understands their particular needs. Another argument that was out there was that you can't just send 9 million veterans into the private system. The private system itself has long wait times.
And another concern, and you were touching on this earlier, is that maybe people in that private system, a doctor or other healthcare provider, isn't ready to meet the particular needs of veterans. That's something that you write some veterans groups are concerned about.
Exactly. I think Time Magazine did a story recently about a doctor who was doing at the VA who was doing groundbreaking work in concussions from IED bomb blasts. So there's very specific needs, traumatic brain injury, PTSD, military sexual trauma with women veterans that may not really be nuanced care outside the system.
Talking to Emily Wax Thibodeau from The Washington Post about the Department of Veterans Affairs and the challenges facing whoever ends up leading it. There's a quote, I think it was Senator Lindsey Graham saying, evaluating Ronnie Jackson, saying, hey, this isn't a job for management. This is a job for attitude. We need somebody with the right attitude to come in and change things. At the same time, this is a huge managerial task to run this huge agency. Is there something to be said for somebody with a different attitude being able to shake things up there?
I think you need, and I was speaking to some experts on how to manage government who study this. From what they were saying, there needs to be someone who can hire the right people. This is a job no human being could do. It is in charge of cemeteries, the GI Bill, home loans, a hospital system, which is one of the largest in the world. There's no one person who can do all that. The person needs to inspire and hire the right people. Then that will trickle down. That is the hope.
That said, and on top of that list you just gave, this person also has to go to Congress and negotiate issues like outsourcing of medical care and has to deal with White House politics. Is it just that the resume, this job list, is too long to find the right person, and that's why we can't point toward a lot of success stories in recent years?
It's a very hard job. People say it's one of the hardest in the government. One issue that comes up a lot is the politics. You have to go to Congress to ask them to fund caregiver acts, GI bills. Every time there's a new need, then money needs to be appropriated. So that's a huge part of your job, never mind all the people you have to inspire, the benefits claims, the disability rankings. It is a massive undertaking. And some of the top jobs at the VA are currently acting jobs or haven't been replaced yet.
Does that uncertainty at the top, some of those top-ranked jobs, and, of course, the big boss, now one is gone, one just stepped back as a nominee, does that kind of uncertainty make veterans worried, make potential employees of the VA worried?
There's a lot of career professionals who say the hospital doors are still open, the vet centers are still running, people who need rehab are getting their services. This is politics, and then there's what's going on the ground. All of this politics, what is it about? Well, it's about the people you send to war. When they come home, what do they get or not get? And I think that's, you know, that's something Americans care about. If you're a veteran who's suffering from PTSD and you have a therapist and you have appointments, you're going to them. So they feel like things are still moving. It's not paralyzed, but there's definitely a sense of confusion and disappointment in what's been going on.
And are there any thoughts now of the type of person that might be sought out as the next head of the VA?
It's not clear at all yet, so I couldn't answer that question with any authority. There are names being bounced around, but no one is sure if they're accurate yet.
Emily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure.
Emily Wax Thibodeau is a national reporter covering veterans and the Department of Veterans Affairs for The Washington Post. We talked with her about a recent story titled, "Here are five urgent problems a new VA secretary would need to tackle." If you think about British English, what do you think of? Is it something like this?
Now, the trick to making a truly perfect cup of tea is to coax out the tea's natural essence and subtle flavors by ever so gently vocalizing your desire. You want to make the tea feel comfortable at this point. So, help the tea let its hair down. Let it relax. Let it steep in your passion. That's it, darling. Take your time.
Or is it something more like this?
Yeah, because I prefer it being a band, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So now on your jacks a little bit, it's a bit more better when you're with the lads. Even though the lads are there and that.
Yeah.
Well, see, now I've got to do all this chatting, haven't I?
You know? Yes, you see, that's
there's no way to send over, no, you know what I mean? He's good at all this kind of thing, you know what I mean?
Those are In Order actor Benedict Cumberbatch talking about that very British institution of tea, then English singer and songwriter Liam Gallagher, who hails from Manchester. Some pretty big differences there. Now, how about the differences between American English and British English? Our next guest is an American linguist who works in England. She's noticed a lot of differences, big and small, that sometimes lead to confusion. Lynn Murphy is a professor of linguistics at the University of Sussex and the author of the new book, The Prodigal Tongue, The Love-Hate Relationship Between American and British English. She's also the author of the award-winning blog, Separated by a Common Language. Lynn, welcome to Central Time.
No problem. I'm happy to be here.
How long have people in England, in particular, I guess, worried that we here in the United States are ruining the English language?
Well, probably almost since the beginning of America. There were people in the 18th century, in the 1700s, complaining about American words and American accents. But it's really been since the late 19th century that people are worried about American English ruining British English.
Yeah, they're worried about loan words and Americanisms coming over. You say people are writing about this all the time.
Yeah, I mean, the letters to the editor of any newspaper, you know, it comes up again and again.
And there's this sense, and I think this is probably true on both sides of the ocean, this sense that, okay, over there on the islands, that's the original language, timeless and enduring. And over here in America, we've split off from it and innovated. You write, that's really not true.
That's not really true, no. I mean, English changes all the time, no matter where it is. And in England, it's changed a lot in the last few hundred years, even a lot in the last century. So, the idea that American is somehow the one that changes, and in Britain it stays the same, that's just not true.
A lot of people try to compare and contrast common words and phrases in both languages. One of the things I loved in your book is usually when you see a news article or a tourist guide or whatever that lists a bunch of things like, oh, here's what Americans call this, here's what British people call this, usually about a third of them are just plain wrong.
Yeah, a lot of them are wrong, and a lot of them just miss the subtleties, you know, because, you know, if you do something like a truck is a lorry, well, not everything that's called a truck is called a lorry. A pickup truck isn't a lorry. You know, a UPS truck wouldn't be a lorry. It would be a van. So, you know, there are all sorts of subtleties that get missed in such translations.
Well, as an American linguist living in England, what were some of the first things that struck you as real differences that could maybe even create confusion?
Well, you know, because I work in education, there was just a lot of jargon for education that I had to learn. When my students say that they're coming to my lessons, it makes me feel like a piano teacher rather than a professor, you know. So there are all sorts of little things like that. But the funny thing is, I've been there for 18 years. There's not a week that goes by that I don't learn something new that I didn't know before about British English or even about American English, because you don't realize until somebody doesn't understand you which things are your dialect.
And one thing that's got to make it harder is they're both sides of the language. They're moving targets, right? It's not like they're fixed in place and forever.
Absolutely.
They're changing. So I'm learning new words in American English all the time.
Yeah, I mean, they're not fixed in time, and also there's so much variety within either country. So, you know, you go to a different part of the country and you learn a new set of words or a new set of expressions.
And you write that you've encountered this and seen it written. A lot of times British people will be pleasantly surprised at how articulate an American is when they talk.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two stereotypes that go on, either that, you know, Americans are not very well educated, or that we are really, really good at public speaking. And you get both of those stereotypes sort of living side by side. And I think part of that is that Americans have been taught to be confident in their own voice and to, you know, be encouraged to have their own opinions on things. And so we do that well.
Let's look at some of the words that are different. I was just reading the bit about the word quite. Oh, it's quite cold outside, or however you want to use it.
Mm-hmm.
It can mean exactly the opposite or almost exactly the opposite thing. Talk about that.
Yeah, it's really tricky in British English because sometimes quite means somewhat. So if you say you're quite happy about something, you're not very happy about it. But if, you know, something was quite dead, you know, the phone line is quite dead, you know, that would still mean very in that case. So there are all sorts of ways that quite is used in British English that don't really translate well into American English.
So if I said our conversation is quite interesting...
Oh, that would be the kiss of death.
Right. And I mean, oh, it was really very interesting.
Yeah.
But in England, you're like, oh, so you're thinking it was almost boring.
Yes, exactly.
And have you run into trouble with that one?
Not knowingly. That's the problem. When you miscommunicate, you often don't know that you've left a bad impression.
So you might come away saying, Lynn thought I was quite boring.
Yeah, yeah. That Lynn, she's not very nice, is she?
Or quite nice, maybe. A little bit, but not completely. And yeah, even in surveys, the options might be very, not at all, and then in between them, quite, which would be baffling to me. Isn't that the same thing?
Yeah, so my local campaigner for a member of parliament seat gave me such a survey, and with, you know, am I quite happy, very happy, or not happy at all with local services. And yeah, I mean, how do you answer as an American to a question like that?
We're talking to Lynn Murphy. Her new book is The Prodigal Tongue, The Love-Hate Relationship Between American and British English. What are some other words that you've encountered that might create confusion that aren't, you know, the stereotypical ones that we might think we know?
Well, I think one thing I found out a couple of years ago was that when I say frown, I mean smiling with my, or the opposite of smiling.
Mm.
And when a lot of people around me said frown, they didn't mean a mouth movement. They meant an eyebrow movement. And that's something that has changed in America during, you know, some people's lifetime. So there are probably still people in America who use frown to mean an eyebrow movement. But, you know, for a lot of us, frown is the sad face emoji, right? And so, you know, you just don't know sometimes whether you're not communicating with people.
And getting back to how we compare and contrast, you say in the States we suffer from American verbal inferiority complex. What is that?
Sometimes, yeah. So it's the feeling that if you're talking to a British person, they must be the better speaker. They must know English better than you do. If they say something, it must be the more beautiful way of saying something, which, you know, not every American suffers from, but, you know, there are quite a few who do.
And often I assume that the assumption, that's kind of redundant maybe, but that we think, oh, British people sound smarter, more sophisticated, more elegant. But you point to some surveys saying that, hey, maybe Americans don't feel that way.
Yeah, I mean, some surveys 40 years ago said Americans think British people sound more intelligent. But when you dig down in that, it's not actually intelligence. It's they sound more educated or they sound more upper class. But in America, educated isn't always the same as intelligent. You know, we value street smarts in a certain way. Basically, when you look at British accents and how Americans stereotype them, very often the stereotypes are a little bit negative. So they sound pretentious or snooty.
There are different accents, of course, within the United States and within Great Britain. It seems like there's kind of a class connection to the appropriate, proper way to talk, probably on both sides, but particularly in Britain. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, of course, we've got in America ways that you think of as being more or less educated ways of talking, or maybe urban or rural ways of talking. Those are big ways that we stereotype accents here. But in Britain, it really is all about class and whether you have a posh accent or a middle-class accent or which middle-class accent you have. This often gets tied up with regional accents. So the higher-class accents sound more southeastern. And so people in certain classes, even up north, will sound more like southeastern people than they sound like other northern people because they're getting the accent that goes with their class.
If somebody was going to try to do a stereotypical English accent here, there'd probably be, you know, Cheerios and Lorries and Bobbies and things like that.
Yeah.
When people there are maybe impersonating or talking like they think an American talks, like, how does it sound?
It sounds like a Valley Girl. Valley girls and rappers is what it sounds like. Occasionally you'll hear people do something more twangy as an American accent, but in general they go for a very stereotypical Californian sort of sound.
That's funny. What pops into my head, and this is dated a bit, was Monty Python episodes in the 70s where if they were doing, these are English people, if they're doing American accents, they're just sort of shouting and a pinched shouting voice. And that's what an American sounded like, maybe in 1970s England.
Well, I think if you talk to people of a certain age, they'd certainly have that kind of stereotype that Americans sound like business people and we're always trying to, you know, make deals.
Another thing that, getting back to the worry about Americanisms, is the idea that Americans are creating new words that aren't really right to be used. And this goes back a long way. You talk about, I think it was Thomas Jefferson creating the word that I would take for granted now, belittle, to belittle something.
Exactly. I mean, when Thomas Jefferson first used belittle, he actually meant it literally, to make something smaller. And now it's grown a more figurative meaning where we mean to make it less important. And British people use that word now, too, and don't realize that it came over from America. But when he first used that word, you know, the magazines and the literary magazines in Britain were up in arms about it.
Are there new trends that you're noticing in how British English and American English compare and contrast?
Well, I don't know if I have trends in how they compare and contrast. The accents are going in different directions. You can say that for sure. So a lot of people in Britain in particular worry about, you know, we'll all speak the same English soon. We won't. We share a lot more vocabulary than we have in the past because we have so much more contact with other people through the internet, through international media. But, you know, on the other hand, the way people talk at home tends to still stay rather different and moves in different directions.
And Lynn, if we were both English in this modern era, we probably wouldn't sign off our conversation by saying cheerio, would we?
No, we probably wouldn't unless we were about 90 years old.
Well, Lynn, I'll say thanks a lot. It's been fun.
Thank you. It's been a good time.
Lynn Murphy is professor of linguistics at the University of Sussex in England. She joined us to talk about her new book, The Prodigal Tongue, The Love-Hate Relationship Between American and British English. You can learn more at her blog. It's called Separated by a Common Language.